Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Dr. Mark Smith as my special expert guest. Dr. Mark J. Smith graduated from Loughborough University of Technology, England, with a Bachelor of Science in PE and Sports Science, and then obtained his teaching certificate in PE and Mathematics. As a top-level rugby player, he moved to the United States and played for the Boston Rugby Club in 1987 to 1988 while searching the American college system for an opportunity to commence his master's degree. That search led him to Fort Collins, Colorado, where Dr. Smith completed his master's degree in exercise and sports science at Colorado State University. He continued his studies in the Department of Physiology, where he obtained his doctorate. As an affiliate faculty member in the Department of Exercise and Sports Science at Colorado State University, Dr. Smith worked extensively with Dr. Lauren Cordain, the renowned author of the book The Paleo Diet. Later, Dr. Smith began his work with Exizer Industries as the Director of Research and Program Development and now holds the same position at Corrective Wellness, which runs Exizer.com, the research, marketing, and sales company for the Exizer machine. Dr. Smith spent years researching and developing innovative high-intensity, short-duration training protocols and is a leading authority on the health benefits of this type of training. Today, he pursues a genuine interest in the prevention of disease and the optimization of one's health by lifestyle modification. Good morning, Mark. Welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update.
Well, thank you, Corey. It's a pleasure to be on with you today.
It's really our pleasure indeed. Now, I want to talk a great deal in this interview about high-intensity training, interval training, but first, can you tell us about yourself, maybe something about your athletic background and why you decided to pursue the career that you are in sports science, health, and fitness education?
Yeah, you bet, Corey. My background goes back to being a typical jock in the UK. I was a rugby player and a tennis player. And I remember my parents wanting me to sort of decide what career I was going on. And I went for a trip to a chemical engineering plant, and my mother was all excited me coming back, and I had this long face, and my parents really pulled me aside and said, you know, what's your passion, what do you love? And that was sport. So the establishment, not to credit you, it's Loughborough University, it's spelt rather strangely, in the UK is the sort of top institution for sports science, and I had a huge desire to go there. So my parents encouraged me. It was very tough to get in. You had to be a very good athlete as well as be academically sound. So I was fortunate to get into Loughborough University, and it was a course that I took there that got me into sports science. It was one of the professors started a new course that was just basically called health-related fitness, and it was within that course that, you know, I learned the fact that 50% of mortalities were due to heart disease and that they were preventable with lifestyle modification, and that just really hit home. And I at that time, a lot of the professors at the university had done degrees in the States, so we all had a pretty strong desire to come to the States to pursue a master's degree after our bachelor's, and that's indeed what I did. And so I found my way to Colorado State University, where I did both my master's and my doctorate. And with regards to sport, you know, I continued playing at a high level of rugby through my time in Britain, and then also continued in the States as well while I was actually doing my graduate work.
Now, rugby is a great sport. It's not as strong in America as it is in England. And perhaps you can answer why that is and what attracts you to rugby as compared to, say, football or baseball or hockey or lacrosse?
I didn't have the opportunities of those other sports. You know, it's sometimes cultural. For me, it was my heritage is Welsh. And for anyone that knows the Welsh heritage, rugby is a huge sport there. So for me, it was very much, you know, what my father had played and got me into that. Obviously, soccer is a bigger sport in the UK than rugby, but it's obviously big. And I think a lot of people don't realize how big rugby is in North America. Canada is probably stronger, for the most part, a stronger nation than the US. But it's growing here, and obviously I think the biggest hurdle for them is to make the sport professional so they can compete on the world stage. Right now, you've basically still got sort of semi-professional athletes trying to compete with what is now a professional sport worldwide.
You know, it's the only sport I basically didn't play because it was played at the same time as some of the other sports that I was exposed to growing up in Canada, Mark, and I always looked at it with amazement because I thought, like, these guys are playing almost like a football game, and there's a lot of contact, but they've got no padding at all. And then I used to hang out with a bunch of rugby players, and these guys are like the ultimate definition of crazy. So I wouldn't say it's a violent sport because these guys are true gentlemen on the field. And I know a trainer in England, he says that the most noble athletes in the world are the rugby players. Would you agree with that?
It definitely builds character, there's no doubt about it. And there's no love lost on the field, but afterwards it is a gentleman's sport and people shake hands and, you know, commend each other for what went on. The game has become a lot more physical in recent years since it's become professional, almost a bit more like football where there's perhaps less dexterity needed and a little bit more brute force. But, you know, a lot of people often used to say, you know, there's no pads. I'd rather play rugby and not have a helmet coming into my back where there's no pads. And most people, you know, they get their head out of the way. So the head isn't used as a weapon that I see in football. So it's not for the mild. I don't think it's as brutal as football. Not even close.
Now, you've got a lot of research background in a lot of different areas of science. And one of the questions that came to mind is, first of all, when it comes to athletes and nutrition, what do you think are some of the most important principles that the recreational, the fitness, or the competitive athlete needs to keep in mind when they're eating food?
Well, I think you know, Corey, I'm a disciple of Dr. Laurent Cordain, and I listened to his interview last month and thought it was a great interview, as always, whenever Laurent is interviewed. So I'm heavily influenced by Laurent's research, and then that led me into then the clinical experience over the past 15 years. So what I do now in my clinic is I use an analogy of saying to people, if I had a stack of $100 bills, a stack of 20, stack of 10, stack of 5, stack of 1s, and you can only pick from one pile, which pile would you pick from? Obviously, everyone's going to pick from the $100 bill. So what I then try and do is educate people what are $100 bills, what are 20s, 10s, 5s, and 1s. So sometimes, you know, they hear in the, you know, the old food pyramid, you know, you've got to eat 6 to 11 servings of grain. So I explain to them why grains in high consumption are not $100 bills. There's negatives to grain consumption. There's some positives, but not a whole lot. So I do it in that format. So in terms of what influences health and performance for me, I'm absolutely convinced and very open-minded. So I'm always looking for different applications. But for the best maintenance diet, I've been doing it too long with too many people and for myself to deviate from what Dr. Cordain professes, and that being lean protein, vegetables, fruits, nuts, and seeds. And it's easy to argue that with that analogy of the dollar bill stacks.
Right on. And what about dietary supplements? Do you think they have an important role in human nutrition?
Well, I do. Particularly, if we were to take a child from a young age eating probably organic, you know, sometimes, you know, that word is used a lot these days, perhaps, you know, local farms where the soils aren't depleted of minerals and vitamins. So essentially, good, naturally produced, locally produced produce, lean animals, etc. If we were eating that way from a young age, I think the supplementation would be less necessary. But that's what I really view it as. It is supplementation to compensate for the lack of what many people have undergone through these years, eating such a terrible diet. So I've often sort of discussed with Lauren on this, you know, maybe with eating the Paleolithic approach, we could get to the end result of the goal of their health in 10 years. I think with supplementation, we can get there sooner, particularly with some of the testing we're able to do now, with some of the, you know, the lab work we can do, and we can see a massive deficiency. And sometimes that deficiency may be due to, you know, a leaky gut or something going on that even with eating correctly, it's just going to need more. And I think it's sometimes hard to do from diet alone in certain individuals. So it absolutely has a place. And obviously then to the athlete, that's another ballpark again. And I think that's where it plays a huge role as well.
Right on. That makes a lot of sense. Now, let's talk a little bit about cardio in terms of volume and intensity. But before we do, maybe you could just give us a good definition of what aerobic exercise is and why it's important to the health model.
Well, when I do my seminars, I often throw this up. I put two words up, and I just put aerobic versus anaerobic. So and I just ask people first, what does aerobic mean? And it's funny sometimes, particularly if you've people in the audience that have some knowledge of exercise physiology, you'll get this very sort of complicated, long definition. And I said, okay, I'm looking for something simpler than that. And all I'm looking for is any exercise that requires oxygen. That's really what aerobic means, is requiring oxygen. I said, well, I don't know of any exercise out there that doesn't require oxygen. So everything is aerobic. You're aerobic now, just sitting down. I said, so it's sort of this myth of the aerobic's got to be the long, slow, continuous was a big problem. And the term anaerobic, which I then say, what does anaerobic mean? That means without oxygen, the an being Latin. I said, that has been given this sort of bad term. And the point I always want to get through to people is you cannot be purely anaerobic. You are always going to have an aerobic component, and we can discuss more in that. But that was some of the more modern research has shown that the kinetics of oxygen consumption is different to what we've heard. You know, so a lot of the old textbooks are really a bit antiquated in their description of how oxygen kinetics occur. I mean, if we're wanting to do a sprint, for example, they've shown now as much as, you know, the oxygen kinetics, you know, well over 50% from the aerobic pathways through the mitochondria are occurring in that sprint. We didn't used to think that. So it's not this sequential, you go through the ATP, phosphocreatine, then you go through glycolysis. It's not like that. The body, and it makes sense, the body's going to give all it can from every energy source. So they're all working together. But in terms of, you know, it is crucial that we have a good aerobic capacity. Now, good aerobic capacity also, I think people sometimes miss the boat there. We think that we've got to have an aerobic capacity of an elite endurance athlete, and that's absolutely not the case. What we don't want is the aerobic capacity, you know, sort of down in the very low numbers of something like, you know, less than 20 milliliters per kilogram per minute. And if people are wondering about those units, if they're not familiar, I always tell people an average college-age male would probably be about 45. Don't worry too much about the units, and females about 35. These elite endurance athletes can have as high as, you know, 80 in the males and sort of the 70s in the females. And there was this, because of the early sort of bias in the sports science research, it was almost as if that's what we're trying to get the general population to become, which is not necessary to be healthy. And my experience in measuring sort of sprint-type trained athlete or people that lift weights but do it vigorously and are breathing hard when they do so, have very healthy aerobic capacities, and I'm the first to say it's important, but we don't need to get to the level of these endurance athletes, and it can be accomplished with high-intensity, short-duration sort of weightlifting, sprinting, that type of approach, and I'm sure we'll get more into that. So I'm saying, yes, I agree, it's very important. The difference is, how do we get a healthy aerobic capacity? It doesn't have to be this traditional cardio conditioning that everyone thinks they need to do.
So if I was going to do some underwater swimming, which means I can't breathe in oxygen, you're saying that that's still an aerobic form of movement?
Well, when you'll part of it will be, because you've obviously got some oxygen within your body, but there'll be a limit to how long that will go. But if we were to just do a minute and you started off and we actually looked at where the energy sources were coming from, you bet there's going to be some aerobic contribution, because there's already oxygen in your system. Now,
right,
it's going to
so
run out,
consequence
right?
of the oxygen limitation, then we start moving into a different alternative fuel source, which is very limited and generates a lot of waste, which gets in the way of, I guess, power production and muscle contraction.
Well, right. I mean, it's actually, I like that sort of question, because it sort of makes you really think about it. And I think what that makes you realize is the body's going to basically get energy sources as quickly as it can from wherever it can. So we know that anaerobic metabolism, it can produce energy very, very quickly. So that's why, obviously, it's a major contributor in high-power events. But there's byproducts, you know, and essentially, you know, lactic acid being the primary byproduct of anaerobic glycolysis. And I always tell people it's a good thing that there is that, because if it wasn't, we'd continue to produce such levels of lactic acid, you'd die of acidosis. So it's a negative feedback inhibition. But when you're doing activities anywhere, you know, up to, say, 60 seconds, that's sort of the point at which we would then fatigue dramatically. So, you know, a minute is a magic number for any human in terms of giving an all-out effort. So I always try and accumulate mini intervals or a full 60 seconds with all my clients and then give them a recovery.
Very good. Now, what about the model that has been positioned in the gyms in North America, where you have a woman who wants to lose body fat, could be a man too, but more so with women, I find, and they come into the gym and they're doing a lot of volume of cardio. You see them for hours sometimes on that treadmill or elliptical machine. And what you're saying is that if they were open-minded to try this approach with the interval training, the high intermittent intensity, that they could get better results faster?
You bet. I mean, the research is absolutely unequivocal, and I think you're going to post a recent paper that I took some time to write, and it goes through a historical perspective of looking at the research all the way from the sort of 60s right through to present day. And I sort of get after that question in a number of areas. I sort of say, okay, let's look at it from a common sense perspective, and let's look at it from the research. I'm telling you now, the research, whenever they've compared long, slow cardio, or what I call low to moderate intensity continuous training, to sprint interval training or high intensity interval training, when they've compared them side by side, the sprint interval training has always been more beneficial if we take into consideration the time involved. So it's either they've produced equal results with a smaller investment of time from the sprint interval training, or the sprint interval training has actually produced better results, both from a cardiovascular improvement and from certainly from a weight loss. So what I do, I think, you know, if people go to your site then, Corey, they can read sort of the science in a 30-minute sort of interview like this. I don't want to get too much into the research. We'll maybe address a couple of points. But I think what's often important for us in the healthcare community and as trainers and lifestyle coaches, we're often having to persuade or educate our clients. So sometimes research isn't the way to go with that, because they'll sort of gloss over. But if we can just make them think about it from a common sense perspective, they often do quite well. Well, the front page of that article I wrote, I think, is very, very powerful. Basically got a picture of a sprinter and a picture of a marathon runner. Now, those are two extreme ends of the spectrum, which are often, I think, very useful to get an idea of what's going on. You're looking at the sprinter, toned, very lean, in fact, leaner than marathon runners are. That's been documented in the literature. And the marathon runner looks quite gaunt and, to be honest, really sick, in my opinion. So right there, I say, well, who are you wanting to look like? Well, let's model our program on the sprinter if that's who you're wanting to look like. And certainly most people I work with, that's what they're wanting to look like. So that's a very sort of quick sort of image that helps people. And then from a common sense perspective, I talk about the athletic world in sports. If you name a sport and they start naming all these sports, most sports are interval-based. We go hard, we recover, we go hard. Rugby, soccer, baseball, you name the sport, ice hockey, all of these different sports, high intensity, and then recover. Well, in the past, we used to get fit, so we were lean with not much body fat, and we had good cardiovascular conditioning from just playing sport. We didn't do a lot of training outside of playing sport years and years and years ago. So that's another common sense thing. And then I often go back to very primitive times, talking of Lauren Cordain and Paleolithic nutrition. Let's talk about Paleolithic exercise. We are not ducks. We're not designed to fly vast distances or go. Now, I always encourage people to walk to increase caloric expenditure, and that's good. And walking we're very efficient at, so that's a good thing. We're very inefficient at sprinting fast. That's a good thing. I want people to be inefficient. We want to be a high-octane fuel Ferrari. We don't want to be a diesel truck going down the highway when we're trying to burn fat. So that also plays into some common sense in terms of, we would have needed sprint interval training to basically survive in primitive times, to either not become a predator or to catch food. So that's one thing. And then the other thing I do to people, I say, look, the body adapts to stress. It's a basic physiological principle. Go walk on the treadmill and half the time they're reading a book or watching TV. How stressed are you when you stop? It's almost as if, tongue-in-cheek, I have a phrase in my paper. I say, you know, most people aren't fit enough to generate any kind of an intensity to enact a change. It's about a nanocalorie above eating ice cream on the couch. I mean, that's sort of tongue-in-cheek, but it's true. You look at these people, and they're really not giving much of an effort. It's because they're not fit enough, because they've been told you're going to go for 20 minutes. But if I say, I only want a minute from you, they can give me some intensity. And then at the end of that, I just say, which one are you more out of breath with? And they're like, well, the minute. It's, you know, vigorous, they're more out of breath with that. So, okay, which one do you think is going to have more of a stress on your cardiovascular system? And they start to get that approach. And what you need to really do is have them experience it. And you make sure that you constantly challenge them so that they are always increasing the intensity. They don't increase the duration. They never go more than 60 seconds. Give them a recovery and do multiple bouts. And it doesn't need much.
I think there's a generalized fear among seniors and older people that this approach would put them at risk for a cardiac event. And I think a lot of personal trainers believe that. And I think that even on the treadmills, you know, they've got the little graph there showing what an optimum heart rate is. And it's certainly nothing similar to what you're suggesting. So how would you convince someone, maybe a 68-year-old woman who's not well conditioned, to sort of buy into this without being afraid that she's going to damage her body?
Well, that's a great question. And that's probably the biggest sort of, you know, I do seminars with a lot of personal trainers, and they're all excited, but then that question comes up, but what about my deconditioned individuals? And sometimes a little surprised by my response. I'm saying those are the individuals that need it more than anyone. And how can I back it up? Well, first of all, I'll go to a research study that was published last year by a group in Norway, Wisloff, and they actually looked at heart failure patients. So we're now talking, we're not just talking deconditions, where people have already had heart failure. They were on medication to control that. But no, these are very high-risk individuals. They were basically, when we talked earlier about the VO2 max, and in that population, we talked earlier about the importance of having a decent aerobic capacity. The aerobic capacity is the number one predictor of death in that population. Now, these individuals had an aerobic capacity of about 13. So this is really low, very deconditioned. So this study looked at interval training versus long, slow, continuous training. They were taking these individuals to 95% of their maximal heart rate. Okay, they had a 46% increase with the interval training versus only a 14% with the long, slow, continuous. That's not even close. And I've even spoken with the author, and I've sort of, why isn't this, you know, being shouted from every rooftop? You know, and I think it's our due diligence to get this research out there. You know, I've written this paper. I want people to read it and share it and get this information out. Because if we're seeing that kind of an improvement in the aerobic capacity with this type of approach, then that's what we need to be doing. Now, the concern about a cardiac event, there's actually more risk, believe it or not, of a cardiac event from a duration than an intensity. I know that might seem sort of counterintuitive, but because of the extra contribution from the anaerobic metabolism, a lot of the training is done after the activity. So it might seem that it's dangerous, but it's really not. Now, let me preface this, though, to make it very safe and comfortable for people. So there is a certain amount of experience. Let's say you take someone that's very deconditioned. I've got a lady right now I'm working with. You know, she weighs 270 pounds, and she's 72 years of age. And I'm doing high-intensity interval training with her. So what I do on a treadmill, for example, I will increase the gradient to 15%. The reason I do that is I'm going to need a lot less speed to fatigue an individual than if I was on the flat. And it sort of takes out a little bit of impact on the joints as well. So they initially look at me as glass eyes and what are you doing? And I say, listen, it's relaxed, and I take it to 15%, and the treadmill's going at 1.5 miles per hour, and I go, pretty easy, right? And they're like, oh, yeah, this is nothing. Okay, so they're comfortable. So we go, well, let's just try taking it to 2 miles per hour in a very deconditioned individual. And say, you're in charge. When you feel uncomfortable, you bail out. So long as you're stressing them, it doesn't need to be an Olympic athlete approach, you know, running 400 meters when they first start out. So you can gradually increase this stress. You don't have to suddenly put them in a position where their life depended upon it. But that does make a very important point. When people avoid this sort of a thing in a gym because they think it's dangerous, they're actually doing a huge disservice to their clients. And this is why. There will be a time in their life, I guarantee you, where they will need a bout of high-intensity training. We don't have a need to run for 20 or 30 minutes in modern day. I talked about it in our primitive times, but it's very true of today. I often talk about you're transferring planes. I often fly through Phoenix, and my luck, I'm always, you know, landing in A, and I've got to go all the way to the other B. It's a trek. And I've usually got a heavy bag, you know, sometimes two. Well, other people are in that situation. They don't think, am I fit enough to do this? They don't think of their fitness level. They're thinking of the goal they've got to get somewhere. Or, they're, you know, let's say they're in a field and they take their eye off their grandchild, and the grandchild's suddenly running away towards a road. They're not going to go, well, am I fit enough to chase? They're just going to do it. So I think it's a very prudent approach to train in a gradual way, in a safe environment, to gradually increase the stimulus of this interval training to an individual so that then they can handle it. So my summary to that is deconditioned people absolutely need to do this. The research is there to support it, and clinically I've been doing it for so long, it's very effective. They see huge improvements, and their lifestyle sort of change modifications, their ability for their functional capacity is a massive improvement.
Now, what about the middle or long distance runners, the competitive 10K or half marathoners, even marathoners? Could this style of training improve their performance?
Well, first off, Corey, people need to realize that the very elite endurance athletes, sometimes 50 to 75% of their training is interval training. You know, so I think a lot of people imagine that these elite endurance athletes, all they do is go out and do what they do when they're performing. They don't. They do a lot of interval training to what we call increase their anaerobic threshold, so that they're able to tolerate lactic acid production, so that when they're pushing it out there. So it's been shown now, and it makes common sense. You want to get good at handling lactic acid, just produce a lot of it. The body will find a way to handle it and deal with it. So that's the first point. Now, I'm not saying that they don't need to do some endurance training. Obviously, those athletes do. But I will make the argument, I think a lot of the athletes, they would probably benefit, particularly the recreational athletes. I don't think they're aware that the elite athletes do a lot of interval training, and they would benefit tremendously if they improve their anaerobic capacity and their maximal power. No doubt about it.
Now, there's the treadmill experience, and there's the whole variety of the Stairmasters and elliptical devices in the gym for cardio, but what exercise technology do you know of that can make this high-intensity exercise training a more natural, everyday experience for athletes and gym people?
Okay, but one thing I will say is also a very good modality, in addition to the ones you just mentioned, is the upright stationary bike, and that's been used a lot in research laboratories. So I use that a lot. I use the treadmill, and then the other one I use is a product that I've been involved with for a number of years. It's called the Exercise Machine, and in your introduction you mentioned that. And it was actually, it's a stair-climbing device, but it was invented by the actual founder of the International Society of Biomechanics in Sport, and he was actually the department chair when I was at Colorado State University. And he was the individual that got me into researching sprint interval training. He made an observation. He was doing a lot of research at the Olympic Games. He was actually the head biomechanics researcher, I think, at the Montreal Olympics. And he had kept in contact with a lot of the athletes. And in about 91, when he was leaving the university, we were still in contact. And he said, you know, start looking into this research. I've just got this feeling that we're going down a really bad path with this recommendation, this long, slow cardio. And he said, I really recognize that the sprinters seem to be healthier, live longer than the marathon runners. Sort of start looking into that. So he was the one that sort of got me into that. But he had made this observation quite a long time ago. So at that time, with a group of international researchers, had tried to develop a product that would actually enable you to sprint kind of on the spot. Because, you know, the stair climbers, all of those actually came from his initial research when he presented at the International Society of Biomechanics and Sport. The big difference was he didn't want one with handles because we wanted to improve balance. That was one of the reasons they were developing this product. And it's very good for improving balance, particularly in the elderly. But more importantly, the ability to sprint on it. So this product, there's no limit to the speed with which you can go at. So one of the reasons I prefer it to the bike and the treadmill, there is a huge balance component. So it makes it very convenient. Someone could literally sprint in their office or at work. But one unique component from a strength perspective is working with a lot of trainers over the years and some other great minds, they give you pointers. And we developed this form on it that we call it the burst form, where we actually lower our center of gravity into the machine with a very upright posture. So you've only got a bend in the ankle and the knees. And we tell people to imagine they have a glass of water on their head and they're firing as fast as they can without bouncing. So the center of mass stays still. So the only way you can do that is you actually have to have an eccentric contraction on the upstroke as well as a concentric on the downstroke. So you actually end up, you don't get that half cycle recovery that you would get when you sprint up stadium stairs. Then the other thing, because of this very stable base, while you're firing the legs like that and the core is working hard from a balance perspective and maintaining that neutral pelvis, we're able to do a double curl and press with dumbbells. So we can recruit a lot of muscle mass. And again, if they go to the paper and read the benefits of recruiting as much muscle mass in any activity as you can, there's a huge hormonal response to that for the better. That's another reason why it's a very effective unit, unlike, say, a bike or a treadmill, which would be very hard to do that curl and press with the dumbbells while you're moving. So it's a unique product. It's been, you know, something I've been working with for over 10 years. We've seen phenomenal results with it, and it's worth taking a look at. People can go to the website and see some videos, and I think we've got some videos now on YouTube, and they can kind of get a pretty good idea of what we're talking about.
Absolutely. I was very impressed with the video I watched of you this morning, actually, and it gives you a great idea of the level of intensity and the value as it relates to, you know, proprioception and balance and core training and the power. And just, you know, you're maintaining a continuous tension for that 1 minute, and you were really out of breath after it. So I think that's a great video. Now, that particular video I watch is on YouTube.
We'll get it put up there. I'll make sure we get it put up there. Or feel free, if you want to send it to any of you or put it on your site, you can feel free to do that video. I just quickly shot it because one of the things we are, as you experience, we're up against sometimes, if the form isn't done correctly, people won't really experience what it can do, which is why I shot that, just for you to sort of realize the intensity. And I would say this, Corey, too, one of the very unique things, and I did a pilot study here in Palm Desert with a lot, mostly females, but there were a couple of males in there. Some of the subjects were as old as 77. the strength component from that position that we get on the unit with the fact that there's a constant tension. To put it in perspective, I've actually, doing a full one-legged pistol squat, you know, with the glutes touching the heel all the way down, I've actually got a record of 50 consecutive, which is obviously a pretty high number, and I know I could never have done that without this. So the strength component is pretty interesting. I've done it with a lot of other people now that have, you know, been unable to do too many of those. You know, they may be able to do one or two, and very quickly they go up to sort of 20, 25, you know, even as much as 30 in a, you know, fairly short period of time. So the strength component is also very, very effective as aside from obviously the metabolic training that it can do.
So that's www.xiser.com. That's xiser.com.
That's right.
And that will bring the students and members to the unit itself. They can look at it and see a video how it works. And this is something that would be great for a consultant in sports nutrition or fitness to offer to their clients to use. I mean, we even had it in the RV. You arranged a meeting with a friend, George, in Colorado, which is ultimately how I connected with you. I think we were close to Fort Collins or Loveland at the time.
Right.
And he brought it in the RV, and I went on it. And so, I mean, it shows you how practical this thing is. It's not a big, heavy unit. It's very light. It's industrial quality. It's made of very good quality metal. And right. I got on that thing, and it was very smooth. I really quite enjoyed it, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's used in, you know, a lot of the NFL teams, a lot of the Major League Baseball, NHL. It's in a lot of the top teams. Obviously, it wouldn't be in professional teams if it wasn't a high-quality product, but it is a very good product for the personal trainer, particularly if you're doing in-home training. There's more than just the stepping you can do. You can go in a plank position on it. You can do a supine bridge, whether you're moving the pedals. You can do a what we call a surf paddle action on it. You can turn around, put your toes on the pedal, going away from the machine, and do kind of a swim kicking motion. So, and all of that is available from the scene on the website. And if anyone ends up interested in getting a unit because they think it would be a useful device for them to apply this, if when they order, if they put in Doc Smith, D-O-C Smith, they can get a discount as for listening to the show today.
So are you seeing patients or do you do personal consultations with clients?
I have a clinic out here in California in Rancho Mirage, California, at Mission Hills Country Club, and we see people outside of the membership base, but probably mostly see most of the members. There's a pretty big country club here. I think there's 2,000 homes here, so we get pretty busy. I work with a colleague of mine who's a physical therapist, Rob Mottram, and he and I sort of on a daily basis just out here trying to save lives. So.
Is there a website for that country club?
Well, they can go to missionhillshealth.com. I think that site's actually in sort of construction at the moment. They can also read a bit more about me at docsmith.org. That's also under construction, but I think it just has a bio up there right now. So docsmith.org is mine. missionhillshealth.com is the site for Mission Health.
Fantastic. Well, Mark, our time is gone. Thank you very much for an excellent interview. I know that we could speak on a lot of different topics relative to health, fitness, nutrition, longevity, anti-aging. It's an impressive amount of information that you have to release and provide to us. Do you have any final parting words for those of us who need a bit of inspiration and motivation to continue on in the vein?
If you're not already applying high-intensity interval training, it's a must, in my opinion. The results are so much quicker, and it becomes motivating for the client. I also make sure, interestingly, with all my clients, I'll do the old stock standard cardiovascular testing that we used to do. So I still use that, and I show them then that the sprint interval training will improve that parameter that they know they want to improve. So it's not just, you know, will they feel better. I actually measure, you know, predict their aerobic capacity with stock standard submaximal tests, such as, you know, the Ashton Ryman bike test or the step test. So I do those measurements, put them through a program, and then test them again. Say, look how much you've improved. But usually I've actually had a lot of people, they almost don't want to do the post-test and pay the money. They look at me and go, well, I already know I'm fitter. I can tell. So, but I think the other thing in what we've talked about today, I would really encourage people to go and read the sprint interval training paper because it's very comprehensive. I mean, I think there's something like 115 references in there. It covers all the research all the way from, you know, the early 60s all the way up to present day. And I think it's a useful read. It's got some case studies in there that are thought-provoking and discusses quite a few different issues in there.
Dr. Mark Smith works with Corrective Wellness as the Director of Research and Program Development. Mark, we thank you very much for your time and this interview.
You're welcome, Corey. Thanks very much for having me here today.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Holly Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHolly.com or call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-866-433-1595. That's 1-866-433-1595. This is Scott Barrett, wishing you the very best of health and fitness for life.
Represent his lifestyle. New way of life. Listen. It's SNU. Sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight. Malik with Sports Nutrition Update. Prolong your life. Live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHolly.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see a change in heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.